announced in August the completion of a free trade agreement for North America. This pact is designed to remove most restrictions on the movement of goods and services between the three countries, and it would create the world's largest trading zone. This agreement, if approved by Congress, would go into effect January 1st of 1994. And would phase out tariffs and other trade barriers over a period of 15 years. Reaction to the agreement has been mixed. Supporters of the pact say that it will make companies in North America more competitive with their Asian counterparts. They say it will also open Mexico to more goods made in the United States and Canada. The critics of the agreement say that it could result in the loss of American jobs to Mexico, where the wages are lower. They also say that it could lead to environmental damage, continued environmental damage, along the border between the United States and Mexico. This morning we have two guests, one at each hour of the program, one which is one who will be generally supportive of the agreement and one generally more critical. In the first hour, we'll be talking with Mary Foley. She's Director of International Trade and Investment Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Then later on, in hour number two, we'll be talking with Don Wiener, co-director of the Fair Trade Campaign. And as always, we welcome your questions. If you have questions, comments, we want to get you involved in the conversation. You certainly can talk directly with our guests and challenge them if you want to agree or disagree, what have you. We only ask that you make your comments brief and stay on point. That way we can accommodate more callers. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. If you want to join our conversation, please do. Ms. Foley, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I think probably when one looks at the possible benefits of the agreement, I think the thing that will come up first and most often is the possibility of opening up Mexico to American goods and services. Mm-hmm. Tariffs in Mexico now average something like 250% higher than in the U.S., and lowering the Mexican tariffs is expected to dramatically increase sales of American-made products in Mexico, particularly as I read things like cars and car parts, computers, telecommunications equipment, and also will make it possible for industries like banking, insurance, investment to do business in Mexico where they have not been able to do that before.
Mm-hmm.
What do you, as you see it and the possibilities for doing business in Mexico, what do you think that this agreement will mean for the economy of the United States?
Well, let me just start by saying that the U.S. Chamber is still in the process of going over the document. As you may know, it was just released on September 8th,
mm-hmm.
and it's over 2,000 pages in length, so
uh-huh.
there's a lot to get through, and we have not taken a formal position yet. However, we certainly are leaning towards supporting the agreement. We think that our member companies believe that the agreement would create new job opportunities in the United States, new investment opportunities in Mexico, and as you mentioned, greater export opportunities to Mexico. In the short term, it would appear that the job gains perhaps are not as great as over the long term. This is mainly because for the time being, the Mexican economy is rather small. The average Mexican consumer does not have a lot of discretionary income. But the expectation is that over the long term, this would grow, and that a richer Mexico means a Mexico that is more able to buy more American products.
Some people, I think, have actually tried to put a number on the number of jobs they think might be created by this possibility of doing more business in Mexico or selling more product in Mexico.
That's right.
Do you have some feeling about that?
Well, there are a number of studies. I can cite you the same studies that I imagine everyone else is. The one that I prefer to cite is one that was done by an independent think tank here in Washington called the Institute for International Economics, which projects that in the first year alone, 325,000 new jobs and 175,000 net new jobs would be created just by 1995. That would, of course, involve the loss of some lower-skill jobs. 150,000 jobs is the projection by this particular study. We think that that is the best study that is out there at this time in terms of the job measure. People do point out the job losses. I understand that. But the position that we're taking is it's a 2-to-1 gain, and that's just within the first year alone. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, it would look like the opportunities get brighter over time, especially in the high-end, higher-skilled, higher-paying jobs.
That it's interesting that you know, when you talk about pros and cons on the agreement, it seems to be essentially the same thing. I mean, those who speak in favor of the agreement say they think that it's going to create jobs, mm-hmm. and the critics say just the opposite, that what it's going to mean is it's going to mean job loss, mm-hmm. and what will happen is that we will see an acceleration of the trend that we have already seen in the past few years of American businesses relocating in Mexico, primarily because wages are much lower, and that it could hit Americans very hard, particularly those people who are now in low-skill, low-wage jobs. And then we have this problem of what are we going to do for those folks? Can we find them new work in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple points. Number one, under the NAFTA, not only would tariffs be removed, NAFTA is the acronym that's being used here in Washington anyway to mm-hmm. describe the agreement, not only would tariffs be removed, but so would investment barriers. And actually, the situation is such that companies have less incentive to move to Mexico under a NAFTA than they do now. The reason for this is, for example, in the auto sector, since you mentioned it earlier, Mexico has some things called performance requirements, which insists, for example, that a plant, let's say an American-owned plant in Mexico, export one car for every car sold in Mexico. Those requirements would be lifted under the NAFTA. This means it would be easier to export a car from the United States to Mexico under NAFTA than it is now. When you combine that with the cut of a tariff, it's even cheaper to ship the car from the United States. When you combine that with the stronger rules of origin that would be created under the NAFTA, which would insist on an even higher percentage of North American-made auto parts included in that car, that means even more jobs for American workers. So there's actually more of an incentive to stay here in the United States under the NAFTA than there would be now. Now, I can't say to you that no companies will relocate to Mexico under the NAFTA. That would be an unrealistic thing to say. What I can say is, at least from the information that we have, no companies that are not now thinking of going to Mexico are likely to move there. Companies that perhaps have been contemplating a move over time, such as Smith Corona, which recently made an announcement, obviously they had been thinking about this for some time before they made the announcement. So that seems to be the information that we have that would actually encourage companies to stay in the United States and export to Mexico. And in the case of Asia, for example, in the textile and apparel sector, the NAFTA would remove not only tariffs on textiles, but quotas as well. And what this would mean is that more investment and more jobs are likely to stay in North America than to move to Asia, as many of the textile and apparel jobs have already.
Let me just go back to a minute to the question of job loss and job creation to make sure that I understand. What you're saying is, yes, you believe that chances are some jobs will be lost, and yet new jobs will be created, and so what we're expecting is actually a net gain,
right?
Although that's
a two to one gain, as a matter of fact. The other thing that I should point out, because I certainly don't want to sound callous in this regard, the Chamber has always supported programs for dislocated workers and businesses who are negatively impacted by the NAFTA. And as a matter of fact, we are in the process of reviewing just what sort of worker retraining program we think would be best suited for this agreement. As you may know, the President has recently put out a new plan that he released that would devote $2 billion over 5 years to worker retraining. Now, we have not come out on that particular program. There are also programs that are already in existence that would be eliminated by the President's plan. We are also reviewing those to see whether perhaps those are better suited and whether more money should be devoted to this in order to accommodate a NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But that has always been the position of the chamber, is that, yes, we should definitely make sure that if there are dislocations, and I can't, you know, say for certain that there would be, but allowing for them, given that all of the studies show there will be some, that a program of this nature be put in place or be given additional funding to make sure that, that workers are not disadvantaged and that they are retrained for the types of high-skilled jobs that would be created under the agreement.
Well, I think one of the criticisms of the agreement has been that there is no such provision in it now. And I also have not had the chance to see it. We didn't quite get a hold of the summary in time so that I could take a look at it. And even that was pretty long. The whole, as you mentioned, the whole thing is very long.
Yes.
But it's my understanding that that problem really isn't addressed.
The problem of worker retraining?
Of worker retraining.
Well, it isn't, but I think that even the proponents of strong worker retraining programs would admit that worker retraining can't really be addressed by trade negotiators. They're really not the specialists on what makes for a good worker retraining program. So it would seem, anyway, that everyone, proponents, and if there are opponents out there of a worker retraining program, which I don't know of, I just don't know of any groups who would oppose that, They are all looking to 1993, which is when the Congress will actually review this agreement in legislative form, and are looking at ways in tandem with approving this legislation to budget for worker retraining and also for environmental cleanup. And those are really going to be budgetary issues to be taken up in the new year. I realize there is some environmental language in the agreement. I didn't mean to suggest that there wasn't, but with regard to worker retraining, it was never suggested by anyone that worker retraining should be negotiated as part of the agreement. Mm-hmm. I think that some in the organized labor movement had made the argument that perhaps wage rates should be addressed, or that a sort of social compact should be come up with as part of the agreement. To build on the 1991 Memorandum of Understanding between the U.S. and Mexico, which sets down some standards for things like child labor laws, right of establishment, right to organize, set working hours, those types of arrangements to make sure that those were put in place. And that was an agreement between the U.S. and Mexico in 1991, which I believe that some critics would argue is not up to snuff and perhaps needs to be built on as part of the NAFTA.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mary Foley. She is Director of International Trade and Investment Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We're talking about the North American Free Trade Agreement. If you have questions, you can call us 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Again, one of the concerns I think it has been raised by some people about the NAFTA is the possibility that increased competition with Mexican manufacturers, mm-hmm. again with lower wages, mm-hmm. will mean downward pressure on wages for American workers. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is any possibility that we might see that?
Well, I don't know of any evidence of that. I cannot say that the studies that I have seen on this issue would seem to suggest that wages would actually go up slightly, that the U.S. wages would go up slightly and Mexican wages would go up a good deal. Again, I'll go back to the IIE study, which I had mentioned earlier, suggests that the U.S. wage rates would stay at current levels under a NAFTA, while the Mexican wage rate would rise about 8.7%. That's the IIE study. Other studies seem to suggest that there might actually be a 0.8% increase in U.S. wages over time. And when I say over time, I mean perhaps 10 to 15 years. The key is that once all the tariffs are removed, and once the Maquiladora program, which you're probably familiar with, those are the twin plant operations along the border area that currently enjoy certain tariff preferences as well as investment preferences by the Mexican government. Those preferences will be removed under the NAFTA over a 7-year period, and that would put those operations more on par with similar U.S. operations. That would make U.S. operations more competitive with those. It would also perhaps put pressure on the Mexican government and on those employers who are located in Mexico to pay Mexican employees more particularly as an economy grows. I mean, Mexico still is a developing country, and as it grows, the pressure on employers located there is likely to increase, and the wages are likely to go up. That could be a chicken and egg situation. The wages could go up first, the social pressure could increase later. But that certainly appears to be the trend that the studies would show.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple callers here.
Yes.
I want to get right to. Let me just ask one further question quickly. I think that some people, as they have been looking at the agreement and trying to understand what is in it, have said that we should be careful about talking too enthusiastically right at the beginning about the benefits, because it will take a long time for all of these various trade barriers to come down, and it won't really happen. It won't happen completely until the year 2000. So that it could be, we might have a long wait before we'd see whatever benefits would accrue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it actually would take until 2008 for some of the tariffs to be removed, although it's a very small percentage that would be in place that long. I think that is true, that over time, that it will take time for us to see the benefits. The other thing to keep in mind, and this is a big part of why that is that the Mexican economy is only 4% the size of the United States economy. So it really is a much smaller economy right now. But as that economy grows, so will the opportunities. And so it is mainly a long-term gain. And I would agree with that assessment that you described.
Well, let's take a caller here. We have someone on line number one.
Yeah, hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Okay. Now, I remember back in the early 70s, we had detente with China, and the business community was just so excited about it because there's this, like, billion-person market that was going to open up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know the particulars in this, but it seems to me that there was a billion people there that didn't have anything to buy any of our stuff with.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we're exporting a lot of things to mainland China now or not, but I do notice that there's a lot of clothes coming from there, and there's a lot of American garment workers that have lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this a radical analogy, or is it close to what might happen with Mexico?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it radical, but it's probably not a fair analogy because China is a state-run government, and the state, the parastatal organizations control a lot of the purchases of goods and services into China. As a matter of fact, it's interesting you raise that because the U.S. trade negotiators here in Washington have been working to try to remove some of the barriers that the Chinese put in place in 1989 following Tiananmen Square. If you've been following the trade numbers with China, you would see that our trade deficit has increased with China since that time. And that has been something that that the two countries have been working toward. So I think given that you have a state-run operation in China and in Mexico, you have every effort being made to privatize those things that are not privatized, it probably is not a fair comparison. Even since Mexico has joined the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, in the early 80s, its economy has grown, and U.S. exports to Mexico have tripled since, I think, 1985. So this is a continuing trend, and under NAFTA, in a situation where there are no tariffs, where there are fewer investment restrictions, where, as I was saying, workers, consumers are likely to gain more discretionary income, they're also likely to be able to purchase more American goods.
Okay, well, I've got another issue to raise. I don't want to get into that too much. There's another thing, too. The last Camaro just rolled off an assembly line in Van Nuys, California.
Uh-huh.
Now, that factory has picked up to move to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Canada generally has higher wages than the United States. So a lot of people would think, well, why would a factory want to move to Canada?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the major difference is that Canada has national health insurance, and it's cheaper for GM to pay higher wages in Canada than it is for them to pay insurance in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so obviously there, when we have Mexico, which has real low wages, and whatever minimum wages laws and worker protection laws and environmental laws that they have in Mexico are obviously not enforced. jobs. And the way that I'm looking at it is that the United States is going to lose jobs on both ends, because instead of trying to bring Mexico up to our standards, we're going to lower the United States closer to the Mexican standards. And I don't want to see the United States continue on its decline into being the third world country, which is basically what's going to happen. If you put some things in this agreement where they have equitable minimum wages with the United States and equitable worker protection laws and equitable environmental protection laws, and that there is an agency over all three countries to enforce those laws equitably, then I might be more in agreement with this. But I don't see that happening.
Well, just a couple points. On the environment, there is very specific language in the agreement under which all of the countries agree they will not lower their environmental standards. As a matter of fact, individual states or provinces, in the case of Canada, would be able to adopt higher than federal standards, and that would be completely legitimate under the agreement. Another thing that the three countries have agreed to is that no country will be permitted to try to woo new investment with any promises of laxer environmental standards. That's a new promise, and that's the first time something like that has ever appeared in a trade agreement. So these are new provisions. The other thing is that you mentioned enforcement of environmental laws, and I think that clearly there have been enforcement problems in Mexico with regard to the environment. But all of the feeling is all of the studies that have been conducted on environmental enforcement in developing nations show that environmental enforcement improves when a country becomes more wealthy because it has more money to comply with environmental standards. It also, as the population becomes more socially aware and has more money, generally the social pressures also increase on a government to comply with environmental standards. So this seems to be the tack that the Mexicans are taking. There's been a lot of movement toward increased environmental enforcement on the part of the Mexicans just in the last 2 years. There was a border plan that was reached between the U.S. and Mexico in 1990, under which Mexico agreed to pay more money toward border cleanup than the United States. I think it was 1.5 times the amount that the United States had agreed to pay. So they are moving in that direction. With regard to a supranational enforcement body, such as you described, that would dictate wage rates and environmental standards for all three countries, I think there's a lot of people in the United States that would be very nervous about the prospect of losing our national sovereignty to such an organization. Keep in mind that, you know, then the U.S. Congress and the White House would lose control over such matters, and I don't know if that's in the best interest of any country. I can't imagine that the Canadians or the Mexicans would agree to something like that either. The wage rates, again, you know, the studies have shown that the Mexican wage rates are likely to go up under the agreement over time. U.S. and Canadian wage rates have stayed fairly constant. There has been a free trade agreement in place between the U.S. and Canada since 1989, under which U.S. exports have increased substantially. So there have been new opportunities created by the trade with Canada. Now, in the particular instance of the Camaro that you described, I mean, it's very hard for me to know. I'm not familiar with that particular plant, so I don't know exactly what was on the minds of the manufacturers and what was behind their decision. But I can tell you that you mentioned insurance. There's many, many reasons why companies relocate or choose not to, and wage rates is only one of them. Other things are things like economic stability, macroeconomic stability, political risk, currency devaluation, whether the currency would devaluate. There are a number of things that come into play, and not the least of which is the education of the workforce. And the fact is that there are many countries in the world today that have lower wage rates than the United States, and yet many jobs are still here. And the reason is because the United States has a well-educated workforce, despite what certain other countries might say. We have a good infrastructure. We have a high level of technology. We have good telecommunication systems. And all of those things are necessary to doing business in a country. And just the fact that we have the first-rate systems that we do have is going to keep high-skilled, high-wage jobs in the United States.
We have some callers to talk with, and we will go for our next person to the toll-free line.
Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I totally disagree with the Chamber of Commerce's position. They're for the business. Our business, like they said, it'll take years before we'll see some advantage from it. We'll see an immediate advantage because Mexico will start buying precision machinery from us, which they don't have the capability of making, and with that, they're going to make the products. A good example of it is Communist China. 5-6 years ago, when we first started getting the first items here, there were rubber sandals that were very poor quality. Then I saw dinnerware come in. It had so many pop marks and pits in it, it was pathetic. Now, all of a sudden, everything you're seeing, there's so many things coming from Communist China, and the quality is excellent now because they've purchased machinery from us and other countries. And it was either in the Tribune or on a talk show that there is not a trade deficit with China. Somebody was complaining of all the items that are being shipped here. The reason for that is because they're buying all this precision machinery so they can make all these items with make quality. So we'll get advantage immediately, but then when they have the machinery, we're going to lose all these other jobs. You cannot compete against $1.60 an hour labor, and we had no benefits. There was, I think it was on 48 hours or 60 minutes, they had a good program, WGM, rather General Motors plant in Mexico. The president, chief operating officer, he couldn't tell them how much his labor costs were. He should know within a penny per hour what it's costing for wages, and they showed the pathetic conditions that people lived in. There was one pump for water for about 200 families. So we cannot compete against that. The only way we can, you bring our wages down to $1.65 an hour, cut our tax and everything, then we can compete. But the way things are, we never can compete against unfair wages like that. And in China, against slave labor that they have there.
Okay, let's get a response. Ms. Foley, can you respond to some of the points the caller made?
Well, they weren't really posed as questions. I understand where the gentleman's coming from. I would say, firstly, we do have a trade deficit with China of about $10.8 billion. So we do have a trade deficit with them right now, and that was one of the issues that I was raising earlier, mm-hmm. that we're trying to, the United States is trying to work that out with the Chinese. On the wage rate, again, I just have to emphasize that all of the studies would show that the Mexican wage rate would go up over time, that it would go up significantly. I would disagree that just because we ship the machinery down to Mexico that they're going to be able to turn around and make a better product right away than the United States. I guess I have more faith in the American people and American workers than that. I think that American workers can make quality goods and could continue to compete with Mexican goods. It would seem to me that even if that were true, that they'd be able to compete with the American-made good, it would take time for them to perfect the skills that were learned here. It would take well-educated workers. We have well-educated workers here. It would take lots of other things that they perhaps may not have quite yet. And I would say that those things would keep us competitive.
All right, let's go on. Let's talk with the caller on line number two. Hello. To call it airline, too?
Well,
yes.
Yes. I was curious. Our trade with Canada has gone up. What has happened to Canada's trade with us?
Well, their exports to Canada, their exports to the United States have gone up slightly, but not as much as U.S. exports to Canada. As a matter of fact, there were some concerns among some in the Canadian public early on under the trade agreement because it coincided with the beginning of a recession in Canada. There was some concern, and still is, that the trade agreement was to blame. What some in the Canadian government would say to this criticism is that the agreement perhaps initially, I don't know if you remember in 1989, but that agreement was very much sold as being as reaping immediate gains for both countries and quite substantive gains for both countries. Unlike this one where people view it more over time growth. And I think that it perhaps was somewhat oversold in Canada initially.
But it hasn't been negative for Canada.
No, it has not.
The other thing I was curious about, the modeling on most free trade programs is between first world countries.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct in that?
Yes.
Has anyone been able to study any situation in which a third world country such as Mexico enters into a free trade agreement with a first world country? Or are we breaking ground?
Well, I think in the modeling that they did try to do for the studies that were conducted on this agreement, I guess they were breaking ground. I don't know of any trade agreements between developed countries and developing countries that are quite of this nature. So it perhaps was a new effort in econometric modeling. That's what you're referring to.
Yes. It gives one pause, although really I have to admit in the long term it's necessary to bring countries like Mexico into the first world for our own economic salvation. Mm-hmm. But we really are perhaps taking a shot into the dark, aren't we?
Well, I don't know if I would call it a shot in the dark. I mean, I think that it's a good opportunity. The Chamber believes that it's a good opportunity for the United States, and it's a good opportunity for the region as a whole. As you know, the Europeans already have a 12-nation European mm-hmm. community, and they are expanding that by leaps and bounds. Within the next couple of years, Eastern Europe could be included in that trading bloc. Asian countries are certainly moving toward their own trading bloc. And the North American region needs to be ready to and prepared to deal with that competition and the situation that could arise from more closed markets overseas. So I think that it's, in a way, it's almost a necessity to ensure that our region remains competitive with these other regions of the world. And if the trend continues, South America and Central America could be included over time in this region, and that, again, would be more developing markets for the United States.
Well, perhaps Mexico is a good test ground. I would point out that the European Free Trade Group is entirely between first world highly industrialized nations.
Well, for the time being, but the association agreements that they've reached with Eastern Europe would bode for possibly some future upgrading of that region.
Even those countries are first world. I mean, they may be economically devastated, but historically they're industrialized and they're not, with the exception of Turkey, which I think is trying desperately to get into that group, mm-hmm. and perhaps Greece, which is in the group, mm-hmm. none can really be classified as third world. Mm-hmm. But as you say, it does seem an economic necessity.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Let us go on again. Line number one is next. Hello.
Yeah, good morning and thank you. A couple of comments first. One is that by my observation, when we start to take a developed area and help another area to develop, at least for a long time, like between the North and the South of the United States, why, we have a tendency to ship the assets of the developed nation or area to the underdeveloped, and the underdeveloped products, to the more developed nation. If you don't believe this, ask our school teachers. But I've got quite a bit of time in Puerto Rico in the late 50s, and something that is going on here at this time went on there, did it not?
A free trade agreement with Puerto Rico?
Yeah. When Puerto Rico became a part of the country.
Uh-huh. Well, when it became part of the country, my impression is that it was given some tariff preferences and was brought into the U.S. taxation system. Is that what you're referring to?
And it had a big program of incentives to move industry down there, mm-hmm. because an awful lot of our industries moved down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, there still are some tariff preference programs with Puerto Rico on goods such as rum, for example. We also have some with
clothing.
We also have some with the U.S. Virgin Islands, but they are territories of the United States, so it's not quite the same as if we were offering a duty-free tariff preference.
One more question, if I may, please.
Yes.
Your organization is primarily manufacturers, is it not? The majority of the people you represent are manufacturers, are they not?
No, that isn't true. As a matter of fact, most of our member companies are small businesses. We have 200,000 member companies across the country of all different stripes. Services, organizations, manufacturers, farmers.
Rather than labor organizations.
No, we do not have labor organizations among our membership.
Could that shade your conclusions? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, when he says shade the conclusions, certainly we would take a pro-business viewpoint of the agreement, if that's what he means.
I suppose
we're certainly trying to take, as I mentioned, we have taken a position in favor of worker retraining. That position is on keel with the organized labor movement. That is certainly what they would like to see if there is a trade agreement passed.
I suppose what the caller is suggesting is that what you would take is a pro-management point of view, perhaps more than a pro-labor
right.
point of view.
Right. Well, I would imagine so. But again, you know, we worker retraining and wanting worker retraining in a NAFTA package is something that the Chamber supports.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest again in this first hour of focus is Mary Foley, Director of International Trade and Investment Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We're talking about the North American Free Trade Agreement. We have some other folks here waiting to talk, and we'd encourage you to call in if you have questions or comments. We will be discussing the same topic with a different guest in hour number two. So if you don't get in the first hour, we'll be happy to take a call in hour two. The number locally, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Our next caller is on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm sure you're going to have more studies that are going to show me completely wrong, but I'll tell you a couple of facts. I've been in the picture frame business for about 25 years. In 1968, I could identify easily 16 major manufacturers of picture frame molding. Mm-hmm. Today, I can identify three. Most of the other ones have either gone out of business or they've turned themselves into distributors. Those goods that are coming that they're selling are coming from Mexico and Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's I can give you all sorts of different companies that we used to do business with that have gone out of business. The biggest one is Vilas Magis in Chicago. And they went out of business particularly because of the Mexican competition. Mm-hmm. Those jobs are lost. They'll always be lost, and they're not going to come back. What they have done is just what that gentleman before said, that they acquired precision machinery up here, and the American manufacturers went down there and established their factories for $1.60 an hour instead of the $10 an hour, and are currently selling their goods here. But they're not being made in the United States, nor are those jobs here. I will say this, though, that the quality of goods is good, and the prices are a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. So, do you have any studies that show that I'm wrong?
Well, in the particular instance that you mentioned, I'm not familiar with that limited sector.
It's not limited. We're talking probably about 3,000 jobs across the country.
Right. No, I understand. I don't know of any study, or I have not seen any part of any study that specifically talks about picture framing. So I really couldn't comment.
Well, I could give you another example of these low glow lights that you see in Roper Ranges, for example. My cousin owned a factory here in Plainfield. Mm-hmm. In fact, they had three across the United States. All of those plants are now down in Mexico. And when I asked him why, he said wages, pure and simple. He went down there, and he had a little story that he came back with. He said that he gave the manager of one of the factories a car. Mm-hmm. And it was just wonderful for him because it was the only car in the city, in the little village where they established it. And when I asked him why, it was wages, insurance, there's no health insurance problems, there's no nothing. Mm-hmm. At that time, it was about 80 cents an hour versus about $8 an hour for a trained wage earner up here.
Well, let me ask you something. Do you think that if there was not a free trade agreement, that those jobs would not have gone to Mexico?
I think if nothing had happened, prices would be higher and there'd be more people working. That's what I think it is. I think that the last 12 years under the Republicans has seen a determined effort to take the keep the prices low and get rid of the jobs. It's much easier to control people who are unemployed, and it's much easier to keep those happy who are employed by giving them cheap imports. And I think it's deliberate. I really do. I don't think it's market forces or anything else. I think it's designed through the tax code. Come to Joliet here. I'll take you down to see U.S. Steel. Closed in 1983, 7,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. Why did it close? Because of a tax break. Come to GAF over here on Broadway Street. 783 people lost their jobs after they had built a brand new plant that was the most productive plant in the world because they built it after a fire. It was absolutely brand new, and they closed it, and now they rent it out to somebody else, and they did that because of tax breaks. I'm not an economist, ma'am, but I see 8,000 jobs lost in this little community here. And it's all been in the last 12 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just think either you're very naive or pushing the company line or, you know, there's it's just an outright lie myself. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to insult you, but...
Well, it's okay. I just want you to...
What you're saying.
I want to make sure that you know that I am not with the Bush administration. The Chamber of Commerce is a business organization. It's not... Part of
no, you don't have to really be with an administration to follow that kind of line because they're really feeding what you and is profiting you. But no, I wouldn't accuse you of being a Republican or even being a Reagan Republican. But those are those programs have benefited the manufacturers who have the ability to move. And it has been done at the expense of the American worker.
The point, if the caller won't mind my jumping in here, the point he seems to be making, and a lot of the other people have made, and I think that it touches on this fear, this general fear that the flight of jobs from the United States is only going to continue. Perhaps if there was no NAFTA, it would happen anyway, but there is this genuine fear that it's only going to make things worse, and that you know, one might point to studies that say that we can expect wages in Mexico to rise dramatically, and so they won't have that competitive advantage, but the fear is still there.
Right. Well, and I certainly understand it, but I guess the point that I would make is that you can't stop companies from making a decision to move. I mean, that's if the company is going to move, unfortunately, that's their decision and that's their right. But the situation is that under the trade agreement, the wages could go up, and as I mentioned, the barriers to exporting from the United States would go down. So the incentive is actually to stay here under the trade agreement rather than the other way around. Hmm. And that was the point that I tried to make early on.
I suppose you could. I mean, if as a matter of government policy, if you decided that you were concerned about businesses leaving this country, one could do something about it. I wouldn't imagine that the business community in this country would appreciate that very much. But it would be possible to do something, whether by incentives or mandates, to prevent jobs from leaving, wouldn't it?
Well, through incentives, and certainly through incentives, you could try to keep companies here. That's for certain. But this is a free country, and I don't think that under a free country, the government, unless the government were to buy a certain industry and for that industry to become state-owned, for the government to say, you must stay here in this country or you must stay in this locality, the incentive has to be given instead. That's really, in our free country, that's really the only way.
We do have a couple of callers who are waiting, and I hope the last caller, again, will forgive me if I move on to try to include some others. Line two is next. Hello. Is there a caller on line two?
Hello?
Hi. I can't give any testimonials like the last caller, but that was... Actually, I think you should just call back. I don't share your premises either about you know, what a boon this will be. Free trade is sort of more of a buzzword than anything else, in my opinion. But what I wanted to talk about was just how unfree Mexico is. Nothing against the poor people mm-hmm. in Mexico, but they basically had an election stolen. They have had journalists killed. Maybe it doesn't show up compared to what's going on just south of there. But workers are generally very, very oppressed, and that's how that wage remains low. And that's what I see is what manufacturers are planning on benefiting from. And that is a really insidious thing. And I think it might actually cross the border, too. Another unassociated point is that my understanding is that according to GATT, and the Europeans will probably be clamoring on us about this, is that when these kind of economic relations are done, they should go along, at least this is the premise of GATT, they should go along with political cooperation so that when you start merging economies, as is being suggested, that there should be cooperation and political review. So these kind of... So there can be some kind of supranational review of, you know, what kind of means nefarious or otherwise are going on in Mexico or wherever to keep the labor market docile and disciplined, et cetera. Obviously, I don't expect any agreement, but I would like for at least your comments on what you think. Do you know that the Mexican election was stolen?
Well, I know something about the situation you're describing. I don't know enough to say whether it was stolen or not. And I certainly, you are not the first person to raise this concern about the political instability or perceived or real in Mexico. I think that one of the things, though, to keep in mind is this is a commercial agreement between the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, and it really would not, I think I made the point earlier about trade negotiators not being qualified to address worker retraining issues. I also don't think that it would be in part of their portfolio to have them addressing matters of social charter or something that would fall under a social charter. The one thing that I could say is it would seem, though, that through improved and increased cooperation between the U.S. and Mexico, perhaps the standards in Mexico, in elections and elsewhere, would improve, and perhaps the U.S. and Canada would be able to exert more leverage or at least more moral suasion over Mexico. Everything that I have read about Mr. Salinas is that he is working very hard to eliminate the corruption in Mexico. And this agreement would help to keep him in place. He has an election of his own coming up, I think, by 1994, if I'm not wrong. And if this agreement is put into place, then it bodes well for his continued existence as president of Mexico and as a result, additional political stability in the country and improved political stability.
We are going to have to stop there because I'm here at the end of the time. I want to thank you very much, Ms. Foley, for taking the time and talking with us today. Mm-hmm.
You're welcome.
Mary Foley is Director of International Trade and Investment Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.